Okay, so I'm sure you're aware that the SEED team, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, that the SEED lecturing team is extremely talented.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Yes. Now, I think that does as well, right? They're extremely talented in many ways. Now, I, though, have a few talents which much of the lecture team don't know. Don't you just have a conference at the back there? Don't worry, no one can hear you or anything like that. It's fine. It's absolutely fine. You come in, have a chat. Don't worry, no one started here or anything like that. Anyway, so everyone in the lecture team is very talented, right? I have, in fact, many talents, right? I'll show you one of my talents. Are you ready? Are you ready to see this talent? Yeah? Are you ready to see this talent? Watch my arm. Keep watching my arm. Keep watching it. Did you see that? Did you see that? That's talented, okay? But I have another talent that most of the team don't know about, right? Most of the team don't know about. Avi Lazarus knows about this talent. Essie knows about this talent. I don't think anyone else in the room. Johnny definitely knows about this talent. I'll tell you the story. Rabbi Lieberman is the Rosh Kollel in Edgware. Edgware has like an institute for higher Jewish learning called the Kollel, and he is the head of the Kollel, and he is also, as Rabbi Grunfeld said, very weighty. He also wears a long coat, big beard. Very, very impressive man. Now, Rabbi...
Rabbi
Grunfeld's nephew. Is that okay? What's going on here tonight? I mean, seriously, this is like going out, it's completely out of control. Okay, anyway, so Rabbi Lieberman, who is a very, 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 in kind of Yiddish Hebrew, we'd say choshev individual. He's very, very impressive. I learn in that kollel, he's my Rosh Kollel. So on a Sunday afternoon, I got a phone call from Mrs. Lieberman. Now, Mrs. Lieberman said the following to me. She said, "We've asked the Lazaruses to use their house, and we're now locked out of it." I said, "Okay." And she said, We've called a locksmith. And he can't get in. And Debbie Rosenberg said that give Gary Bazak a ring because he can get into any house. That's what she said. But the truth is, I am actually very good at it. It was in summer, right? I am actually very good at it. So I got to the house, right? So I came to the house, came down Mowbray Road, and I could see the locksmith there with one of those very dangerous tools. Do you know those tools that go through the letterbox and can open your door with a mirror? Do you know what I'm talking about? They've got these tools, right? They put it through the letterbox, it's got a mirror on it, and then it's got like an arm that it opens the door with. Very scary, you can buy them in the shops. Anyway, so I came, and he couldn't do it, and obviously, the first thing you do when you go to a house like this is you check the windows, just to make sure, because people often close windows, but they don't lock them. They sometimes don't lock them. So I just check the windows, check the top ones as well, you've got to check those as well, right? Check those, nothing doing. So then I climbed over the fence, being watched by the neighbours, and I got into the back garden to check maybe the back door was unlocked. And even if the back door wasn't unlocked, maybe it's a patio door. Because patio doors, you have to be careful. Some patio doors, you can actually, with a good lever them off their hinges and take the whole door off and get in that way. So it wasn't. It's a regular door. We'll get to that. We called a locksmith. Anyway, so then I climbed back over the fence. And now, by the way, I knew I could get into the house. I was just trying to do it in the... Because the third floor window was open, and I worked out that I could lower myself in from the roof into this little... But it wasn't a problem. No, it wouldn't have been dangerous, because I would have had the locksmith stand there like this. Fine, right? And the truth is, then, what I did is I went over to the door, and I thought, before I go for the third floor window lowering myself in the roof, I think we'll try the door first. And I looked at the door, and I could see that the door had this little tiny plastic thing which was blocking it being closed. So I told the locksmith, just hammer that there. Just hammer it back into place. And he said, no, that's not what's... It's interesting you've noticed that, but it's not going to work. I said, believe me, hammer it back into place, the door will close, it will open. He did it, right, we got into the house, I held up my hands in victory, and I said to him, listen, I want to tell you something. You might have had 7 years' experience as a locksmith, but I have had 25 years of locking myself out of my house. Right? So I am an expert at breaking into houses. Now, the relevant point here is for this lecture. We are going to conclude this lecture in the following way. Sometimes when you need to break into a home, when you need to break into the concept of home in terms of our seminar, you need to pay attention to the smallest things. You need to pay attention to these tiny, tiny details. We're going to come to that by the end of the lecture. The first thing, though, that I'd like to do is review our principles that I set up in the first lecture and explain how they fit into the other lectures a little bit. And then go from there to give them a slightly broader context, add another critical principle. So here's what we said so far. In that first lecture, we presented that a human being has an ability to look through glasses, which I call glasses of self. And when he looks through the glasses of self, when he's interested in his life, when he's interested in promulgating, getting rid of, in carrying on with his life, then what happens is various things come along and pull us away from our life sometimes, which creates a tension. And when we're looking through the glasses of self, then it creates that tension. But we said there was another way you can frame this, which is you need to begin to look through the world through different glasses at the world. And there's another pair of glasses, which is a concept or an idea or a value or something above you, something beyond you, something which isn't just your life, something which is bigger than your life, something which we'll see what it is in a second. But this idea or concept, and you can look at the world through those glasses, and when you look at the world through those glasses, then all of a sudden you become bigger. You become someone who represents relationship, who lives for relationship. You become someone who lives to communicate to your family, to present ideas and present values and to communicate values to your family. That's who you are now. Let's put it back into our context of things. Let's look at the Gates and Ralph's lecture this morning. What was the Gates and Ralph's lecture this morning? I know he said six. I would have made an entire lecture series out of that. In fact, it basically is Robert Herman's lecture series on parenting, to be honest, right? But he presented six deep principles of parenting. But the basic principle, the basic idea, was that you, parent, need to no longer be me. You now need to be an educator. You now need to be who you are is now the person who is going to develop the character of your child. That's who you are now. You're going to look at the world differently because of this. You're going to look at any time your child is pulling away from you as an opportunity now. It's an opportunity to be bigger. It's an opportunity to be greater. That's the model we set up so far. What I'd like to do today is make a critical extra point. And it really is critical. And this is the reason. Because I don't know if there's some people who have been on seed seminars, some people who haven't been on seed seminars. This is my personal opinion. You can disagree with it. Seed seminars certainly help. They do. They're very useful. They're very good. They're very inspirational. But there is a problem. We say, look at the world. If any of you have ever been to the Big Eye seminar, right, which is the Who's in Charge seminar, we say, you have to be a big eye. In this seminar, we're saying you have to look at the world, a similar idea, you have to look at the world through glasses which are bigger than yourself, through a concept, through an idea, and you have to represent that idea. That's all good until your son loses his shoe in the morning. And then it falls apart. Right? And that's it. Right? There's moments in life where we do look at the world through these glasses. But the vast majority of life, we don't. What I want to do is set up, first of all, that context before we go forward. To say, it's okay. We knew about this beforehand. To do so, what I want to do is look at the nature of man. And... No, it's okay. I think we're going to try it with the lights on and we'll see. We'll try it with the lights on, we'll see. We're going to look at the nature of man. We're going to connect it back to Rabbi Grunfeld's lecture. And then we're going to join Rabbi Grunfeld's lecture to this lecture and go on from there. Clear? We're going to look at the nature of man, connect it to Rabbi Grunfeld's lecture, go from Rabbi Grunfeld's lecture back onto all the other things that we've been talking about, and then apply it further. Okay, here's the first point. Man in Hebrew, can everyone basically see this?
Yeah.
Okay, man in Hebrew, the word is Adam. Now, the Kabbalists, we're going to look at two explanations of this word. But one of the explanations of the word is given by the Kabbalists. And the Kabbalists say this is actually a word which represents there being two parts to a human being. Two distinct parts to a human being. This is the first of the parts. It is the Aleph. The Aleph is a very interesting letter. But to understand this letter, we really need to understand a little bit about Hebrew language. The Hebrew language in terms of how it communicates ideas. Because Hebrew is a very, very special language. Hebrew is a language which the words obviously communicate meaning. But more than the words communicate meaning, the letters themselves communicate meaning. If you like, There's a type of language that we have, which is a similar type of language nowadays. If you had a chemical language, NaCl is salt. But the amazing thing about that is that salt, if I said the word salt, and somebody, you know, and somebody didn't know much about salt, he wouldn't be able to tell anything about salt from N. But if I told you NaCl, and you understood what sodium was, and you understood what chloride was, and you understood how they formed, and you understood the nature of the molecule, then you have a description of the entire of the essence of the thing. The chemical language doesn't just give an arbitrary label to something, it describes the thing. The Hebrew language does the same thing, and the letters themselves are, if you like, the molecules, or if you like, the atoms. So the letters themselves have meaning. They have meaning in terms of their numerical value, they have meaning in terms of their structure, they have meaning in terms of their sound. They have meaning. Let me show you an example. Many of the letters in Hebrew are compound. For example, we're going to jump the Aleph. Can anyone see what a Gimel is made up of? What two letters is a Gimel? God, shout it out. Zion. Can you see here? This letter is a Zion. Same as the one over there. And that little letter there is a Yud. An upside down Yud. So it's actually a composite letter. Let's try another one. What about a Hay? What's a Hay made up of? A Dalad and an upside down Yud. Very good. What is a Ches made up of? Two Zions. That's right. Two Zions, right? And so on and so forth. A Shin. It's a tough one. No, it's not actually three vibes if you look closely. No, it's actually made up of two vibes, and this is a Zion. You can tell from the three little things on top. Right, and this is a Zion. Good. Okay, so let's look at the Aleph. Okay, the shape of the letter Aleph. What does an Aleph mean? So you can see already what it's made up of, right? It's made up of two Yuds and a Vav. Now, the numerical value of the word Aleph, of the letter Aleph, is one, because it's the first. Now, one in Judaism always means one is Hashem. I'm not going to carry on teaching the Ten Commandments. Maybe afterwards, right? Maybe afterwards, another one of my talents, right? One. So one is Hashem. But the composite nature of the letter as well is you have a Yud, a Vav, and a Yud. Now, the numerical value of Yud, Vav, and Yud is 10 plus 6 plus 10, which equals. Who said 24? And you almost won the quiz every time. I don't know how that happened. Okay, 26. Does anyone know anything significant about the number 26?
It's like a number.
Not quite. Not it's English, but it is Hashem's name. If you take the deepest, you can't see it probably here, but it's Yud, and then a Hey, and then a Vav, and then a Hey. The deepest of Hashem's names is the same numerical value as 26. So the letter Aleph is one, which represents oneness, which is a description of spirituality. The composite nature of the letter is also a spirituality. It also expresses godliness. The letter Aleph is the only letter in Hebrew which is totally and utterly silent. Do you know that? Every other letter in Hebrew, we've got no Sfardim in the room. That's the problem. But Essie can do it for us. There's another letter which might be silent, which is an ayin in Hebrew. But an ayin isn't silent. You can't do it? Okay, but an ayin is actually a guttural letter. It comes from ayin. No, that you just sound like a frog. Sorry. Sorry, okay. So, Aleph is the only letter in Hebrew which is a totally and utterly silent letter. It just picks up the vowel. Why? Because think about anything very, very deep. Think about anything spiritual. Think about anything which is deep emotionally. It doesn't express itself in words at all. It can't be expressed in words. It's beyond words. Anytime you have this incredibly deep emotion, it's very difficult to actually express it, find the words to express it at all. What you can do, and this is interesting, is when someone else knows that emotion, then you can communicate with them about it, but you actually don't really say any words. Do you know what I mean? When you're talking about a concept that someone else has experienced, and you kind of just go, you know, oh yeah, and you know what, and you both know what you're talking about, and everyone else thinks you're mad, right? So the truth is, in spiritual terms, that's true as well. Whenever the Kabbalists talk about a deep spiritual concept which they can't actually say in the words, they say v'hamevin yavin, which means, and those who understand will understand. Well, that's not very helpful, to be honest, is it? To be honest, I mean, If I understood it, then I'd understand it. Then you wouldn't need to say it. But what he's saying is, if you understand what's going on here, then you'll see that there's a deep spiritual idea. Aleph is a silent letter. What are the next three letters of the Hebrew alphabet? Bet, Gimel, Dalet. Do you know what word that spells? Beged. Why? Because what do begadim do? What do clothes do? They conceal. Because you take the spiritual truth, and when you start putting it in words, it conceals it to a certain degree. Or, if you like, a boged. It's to a certain degree treacherous. It to a certain degree distorts the meaning. Because whenever you take a deep idea and try and put it into words, you'll never grasp it completely. You'll never capture it completely. So to a certain degree, it's a traitor. That's an aside. Let's go back to our Aleph. So our Aleph, if you think about it, is the spiritual side of man. It is the spiritual, is the depth of man. But now, I want to take this a little bit further. What we were talking about in our lecture so far, in our lecture going back to the beginning, you have the spiritual part. Rabbi Grunfeld was talking about the spiritual part of man. This is the beginning of the spiritual part of man. Why? Because this basically refers to essentially anything in the me. Anything which starts getting out of the me is already the movement towards spirituality. This is already a concept. This is already meaning. We're already looking at purpose. We're already looking at where we're going. So that's the beginning. So those are really, if when we say the glasses of the bigger me, what we're talking about is really the glasses of spirituality. So there's a part of a human being which is an Aleph. A deep. Now what happens here is the following. When you put on those glasses, this is the key, you actually start seeing the world through a deeper part of yourself. We all know that. The first time you held that baby, first child, first baby, holding the baby, you connect to a very, very deep place in your character. At that point, if you spoke to this person and you said, what are you going to do with this child? They'll say, I'm going to love it. I'm going to nurture it. I'm going to bring out its character. They'd say all the things that Rabbi Zimmerman was talking about this morning. And then if you said to that person as they're holding that baby, and do you think you'll ever shout at it because it lost its shoe? Okay, I'm slightly different to the normal person. I think you have to understand. No, but you really wouldn't, because at that point, you're seeing the world through a deeper place in yourself. You're seeing your world through the Aleph, the spiritual part of man, the glasses of spirituality. But of course, there are the glasses of physicality as well. What does dam mean in Hebrew? Blood. So there's the physical side of man as well, which is the lower part of humanity, which is the lower part of you, the external part of yourself. Now, this is a classic seed aside. Now, that's where we're up to. We're going to come back to this point in a minute, but I can't resist it because there's a Rabbi Silver thing here. Yeah, you know the Rabbi Silver thing here? Okay. The Gemara says there's three partners in the creation of a human being. Who are the three partners? Man, woman, and God. Man, woman, and God. Okay, so we have Adam. We have the spiritual component. Okay, well we've spoken about that, the connection between that and Hashem, because the Yud Yud Vav is the same numerical value as the name of God. It means oneness. It expresses spirituality. So that is the bit which is invested in by God. But then you have the blood, the physical component. Who gives that? The father and the mother. How do you say father in Hebrew? Av. Aleph is one. Bet is two. Together that is three. Okay, how do you say mother in Hebrew, not in Aramaic? Imma is Aramaic. In Hebrew it's M. Okay, M 40. Mem is 40. Aleph is one. 44. What's the numerical value of Dam? 44. Okay, so this bit is given to us by the father and the mother. This bit is injected in the partnership from God. The spiritual and the physical combined. But that's not the point for today. What was the point for today? This was. Okay, this is up to now, this is all background. This is the point that I want for today's lecture. This is the critical bit I want for today's lecture. You can't see me over there, sorry. We'd like to very much live here. But Rabbi Grunfeld said something very impressive, very interesting the other night. Very, very important. We as Jews don't abstain from physicality and just engage the spiritual. Stay with me here. Just need concentration for 2 minutes. We don't just go off.
I mean, it was fairly obvious. If someone asks you, what did you do this weekend? Basically, you're going to say, we ate. Right? In between eating, there was a couple of things going on. We ate, though. Every Jewish festival, the Egyptians tried to kill us. We managed to escape. We eat. Hashem gave us the Torah. We eat. Right? There's a mitzvah to eat. Hashem gave us clouds of glory. We eat. Rosh Hashanah, it's Judgment Day. We eat, right? Yom Kippur, you're all going, Yom Kippur. No. Because Yom Kippur, the day before, there's a mitzvah to eat, right? And the night after, there's a tradition to eat, right? So we eat. And in fact, on Yom Kippur, if you have to eat, you make kiddush. And you start, we're obsessed with it. So we don't just do this, we do this as well. And when it comes to physical and spiritual, we're very good with that. We talk about that. We talk about investing the physical and the spiritual together. We talk about that. But when it comes to what we're talking about here, people often forget it. When you come out of a seed seminar and you say, I want to put on the glasses of relationship. I want to put on the glasses of family. I want to put on these big glasses of meaning and truth. I want to see the world through. You're forgetting something. You've got the done as well. You've got this all the time. So the real answer to Rabbi Herman's question of why do we shout at the people we love is because we're made up of the glasses of self and the glasses of spirituality. The glasses of physicality and the glasses of spirituality. We have both in us all the time, and there's a natural momentum towards the glasses of physicality. There's a natural momentum towards seeing the world as small people, towards seeing the world as myself. And that's why most people identify with, at the beginning of the lecture, at the beginning of Friday night's lecture, when I said, you know, you get frustrated because your wife wants to leave, your husband wants to leave, and the kid's annoying you. Everyone relate to that a little bit, because we're seeing the world like this. So I'm suggesting, yes, let's make a transition to this, but you have to remember, whenever you make the transition to trying to be bigger, that's still there. It doesn't disappear. And there's always a momentum to swing you back to here. So I'd like to present today's lecture two ideas which in the classes afterwards, in the classes today, this evening, and in the classes tomorrow, we're really going to capitalize on these ideas. We're really going to develop them more, tap into them more, and make them a bit more practical. Could I borrow a watch? I'm not going to like test your like character traits and break it or anything like that, but I just need to know generally what time it is.
Make it go backwards.
Watch! Sorry. Now the only next thing I need to know is actually what time are we supposed to finish?
I shall tell you.
Thank you, Rabbi Jim.
I always carry a program with me.
So do I, but I asked you, should I take off my jacket?
You were meant to finish at 8:30. The time now.
I'm not even going to finish. I'm not even going to finish on time. Finish early. Okay. Here's the next two parts. There's another way we understand a human. This is how we do it. Man is human. Does anyone know why man is called Adam? Pardon? Because he's made from the Adamah, the earth or the soil. Right? The earth or the soil. Now, that's a bit strange, but I mean, it's not very positive. We're made from dirt. Thanks. Right? Lovely. You're made up of dirt. It doesn't seem to be a very positive description of man. So the Maharal says the most incredible thing. The Maharal says, what is the ground? What is the soil? What does it do? So he says the following. The soil is an environment which nurtures growth. That's what it does. Think about it. You take a seed, and this is the specific one. You take a seed, and you put it into the ground, and you cover it over, and then you absorb things from outside of it. We won't talk about that for today. You absorb things from outside, and then the ground is that which develops, which actualizes the potential of the seed. So when we talk about man, says the Maharal, that's exactly what a man is, meaning humanity. An angel... What he's created as is what he stays as. He's called an omed. He stands there. He doesn't move. Man is something which starts off as potential and then becomes actual. I'll tell you a beautiful Rabbi Hirsch. beautiful idea. Rabbi Hirsch said that the world was created with speech. People who come to the parish here know this. The world was created with speech. So Hashem said, let there be light, and there was light. Let the earth bring forth vegetation, and the earth brought forth vegetation. Then it says, let us make man. And everyone's baffled. Who are you talking to? Why is he saying it in the plural? Let us make man. So he says the following. He says, Rav Hirsch says, God is talking to the same person he's been talking to all throughout creation. What is speech? Speech is a medium via which we have a relationship. Speech is a medium via which we connect to each other. So what is the world? The world is a medium via which the person who he's talking to and the person who's talking have a relationship. It's the medium of relationship. That's what the world is. Because the world is God's speech. So it's the medium via which God relates to man. So when he says, let us make man, he's saying the following. I have created you with lots of potential. Loads of it. There's some people who are flexible. There's some people who are tenacious. There's some people who are positive. There's some people who are critical as a positive thing. There's some people who have energy. There's some people who are solid and have foundations. So many different people with so many different types of traits. But all of that is potential. I've given you potential, God says. I've given you limitations. Now you have to actualize yourself. Let us make man. He says, I want a partnership with you, human beings. Let us build ourselves together. I've created you imperfect. I haven't created you perfect, other than Bazek. I haven't created you perfect, right? I've created you imperfect. But now I want you to develop yourself with me. That's exactly the point. That's the point. Adam is Adama. Man is the goal of man, or the essence of man, is to actualize potential. That's stage one. Stage two is the following. This is perhaps one of the deepest ideas that I know, that I'm about to tell you. Hold on to your seats. Now, it's a really, really simple idea, but I think it might be one of the deepest ideas that I know. I know it from my rabbi, his rabbi's rabbi. My rabbi, says my great-grand rabbi. Rav Yeruchim, who was quoted today as well. Rav Yeruchim Lvovitz. So Rav Yeruchim says the following. Rav Yeruchim asks the following question. In the beginning of the Egyptian exile, there is two maidservants. What are they called? Well, I know the names, Rabbi Grunfeld. I'm looking for the English. I know. I'm looking for the English word of people who. Midwives. I've done it. Midwives, right? Two midwives. Now let's try and understand what they did here. Let's put it into modern terms. You had the totalitarian dictator of the regime, right? Totalitarian dictator, and he told them, "I want you to kill all the baby boys." And what did they do? They ignored him. And not only did they ignore him, but they allowed them to live. They helped them. Now, that is what we would call in Hebrew Mesirat Nefesh. They gave up their lives. If they had been caught, it wouldn't have been just death. It would have been torture. It would have been their families would have been everyone. It would have been horrendous. And they gave up their lives for this, which is incredible. Absolutely unbelievable. What does the Torah call them? The Torah calls them Shifra and Puah. Shifra, now that wasn't their real names. Really, it was Moshe's sister, Miriam. And Moshe's mother, Yocheved. But they risked their lives. So the Torah gives them special names. Shifra and Puah. Why? Because Shifra used to be Meshaper Esa Vlad. She used to make the baby look beautiful. Lovely. And Puah, because she used to go poo, 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 poo to the baby. Right? Yeah, she used to make the baby feel nice. Now this is a little bit... This is a little bit strange. Let's go back in time. I'm God, right? Pretend, right? No, don't pretend. Actually live that way. Right? I'm God, right? And I want you. I'm going to write the Torah. So I've got to think of a name of these people in the future. I've got to think of a name to represent. I would call them Chaya. They cause them to live. or Hatzalah, right, or Masira, I don't know, something which represents the depth of what they did. They played with the babies and they made them look... I mean, that's a side point in the story. It's got nothing to do with anything. It's got nothing to do with anything. What's it talking about? So Rav Yerucham says the most incredible idea. And it's so powerful because it affects every part of life. He says the following. He says, there is no such thing in life as great acts and small acts. No such thing. There's only such a thing as great people and small people. Let me explain what he means. A great person... Let's take a step back. When we were preparing for this seminar, I presented the problem which I presented to you at the beginning of, everyone comes away from big eye, small eye seminars, from parenting seminars, all these things, all these great ideals, but then should you invest time in your children? Yes. But what do you want me to do? I work. I get home at 8 o'clock at night. There's nothing I can do about it. It's a very nice idea. Invest time in it. But I work so hard, I can't. So what do you want me to do? And that's how I was speaking to Rabbi Herman. He was a bit taken aback by that, obviously, because I was shouting at him and it was only a small room. It wasn't like a big room like this. It was a very small room. And so he said the following. He said, well, you're right. He was a bit taken aback by it. And then he said that the person who's coming home at 8 o'clock and isn't going to see his children, they could call before the children go to bed. I went, that is such a good idea. That is such a good idea. Why? Let me explain why I don't think people will do it. Why I think people don't do it. Because, I got a phone. I understand, going home early and taking time off work and taking a whole day off work to spend time with your child. I can quantify that. That's an act. That's a real thing. A little phone call. What does a little phone call do, really? Right? Come on, really. This is Rav Yerucham. Rav Yerucham says there's no great acts and small acts. Don't look at acts. That's not what's important. What's important is, are you great or are you small? If you're great, if you see the world like this, or if you try to see the world like this, then you have to look at every single act as the most important thing you've ever done. Then you have to look at every single act as, this will build my greatness, this will build the relationship, this is everything. There's no little acts anymore. Every act is big. Every act is important. Every act is special. That's a great person. And a small person can do great acts, but he can do them for totally the wrong reason. He can do them for his own covered, his own... he could do them for lots of different reasons. There's a great person no longer looks at big things that he can do. He looks at every single little detail of his life as an opportunity for absolute greatness. As an opportunity to express this depth, the depth that he understands, the Aleph in the Dumb. He has the ability to express the Aleph in the Dumb, and that is exactly the point. I'm finishing early, but I don't care, because I don't want to schlep. I want to tell you a story which is very close to my heart at the moment, because I don't know if... the people in Edgware probably... The people from Edgware do know. My wife's mother recently passed away. Just before Sukkot, just in between Yom Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, on Rosh Hashanah we were kind of all davening. I was in Seed. I was walking to and from Hendon, because my wife had to be in Hendon because she had to be going to the hospital. It was for a frum family. It was a very emotional time to be, every Shabbat getting a cab into the hospital and getting a cab back. And on Rosh Hashanah, getting cabs into the hospital and getting cabs back. It was a very, very emotional time. We were all praying for life. We were all praying for, the judgments on Rosh Hashanah to be good for us. And unfortunately, this time they weren't. This time they weren't. And my mother-in-law was a very, very, very special lady. And I'm saying that about a mother-in-law. Right? So you really get the magnitude of this here. Right? And she was a real mother-in-law. She didn't let me live anything down. Nothing. Right? I'm serious. Right? She was a real... anyone who knows her... No, she didn't... The truth is, everyone who came into the Shiva said to us, your mother, she always told us about how we should parent our children. It's like, yeah. It's like, but she always did it for the right reasons. Always. So there's an amazing story. It was very funny because we got to the Shiva, and during Shiva, we found out these ridiculous stories about her, like mad stories about her. So I want to share one of them with you. I want to share two of them with you. I can't share the first one because my wife told me not to. Okay, so I can't share the first one. The second one I can share with you. Second one is as follows. My father-in-law used to tell my father-in-law in the morning that she's going walking. 6:30 in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, she's going walking. 6 o'clock. So great. My father-in-law was like, okay, fine. I'm not coming with you. That was about the extent of his relationship to the walk. I'm really happy that you're going walking. 6 o'clock every morning, no problem. So she started walking. And fine, he thought she was walking. He thought that's what she was doing. Someone comes into the Shiva. Right? Someone came into the Shiva and he said the following. Your wife, every single morning for 6 months, used to come to my house because I had to teach. My wife was basically bedridden completely. And she used to come in and she used to make breakfast for the children. And she used to make sandwiches for the children. And she used to make sure that she used to make sure that there were Cocoa Pops. And she used to make... And his wife said... His wife kept saying, you know, you've got to go and buy cereals. You've got to go buy cereals. And he said, no, the cereals are there. The cereals are there. And she goes, well, how are they there? Well, I don't know, but they don't seem to be running out, right? The guy's a bit of a... He's all over the... So, I don't know, they're not running out. So my mother-in-law was going shopping for them as well. So she was literally allowing this person to live his life. And this was the best bit. And this was the bit that he said was the most important bit for him. He said, when I got home, or when she was there looking after the kids, and I got home, and my wife was there, she said, I'll stay down here, you go up to your wife. And if the kids weren't there, she would say, I'll take out the kids so that you can have some time with your wife. He said, that was it. Now, why do I pick that story? I can pick other stories as well. But I pick that story because that's not big. I mean, it is big things. But the things she did were tiny. But the small things that she did express greatness. That's what they were. They were greatness because she did tiny acts. Because she recognized that life is about being an Adam. Is about being someone who is actualizing his potential. Is about being someone who is there to develop himself. Is about being someone who is there to look at the world with eyes of greatness and then put that greatness into every small little act that we do. And when you do that, you'll fail lots, believe me. Right? I'm someone who lives with this perspective, who tries to live with this perspective, and you'll fail all the time. But it doesn't matter, because if you have that perspective, the small acts that you do are expressions of greatness and will stay with you for eternity. The rest of the seminar is going to be focused primarily around those issues. Issues of developing oneself, issues of building oneself. And the reason for that is the following. Because if you really, really want a successful family, if you really, really do want children who are going to be special, if you really do want a family which is going to be full of love, then the only way you can have that family greatness is through the person. Because the person is the vehicle for family greatness if he's someone who is committed to being special himself and to being someone who actualizes his potential. And with that, I'll leave you before we go to the next lecture. Thank you very much for listening.